Hello and welcome to The Europeans, a podcast about a continent of collapsing governments. Is there anywhere in Europe that just has stable, boring government right now, Dominic?
Yeah. Is there? Oh.
Maybe the UK, actually?
Ireland as well.
Ireland?
Which had an election this weekend, and it just seems like the two incumbent ruling parties just get exactly the same vote every election. Well, for the last few.
Reassuringly boring.
Yeah, it does feel like everything is happening right now. I mean, to name a few things, there have been these massive pro-EU protests in Georgia. The French government might have fallen by the time you're listening to this. We're recording on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
I think it seems highly probable. And I just want to say on behalf of France that if our political mess ends up causing another full-blown Eurozone crisis, I am truly sorry. But I also want to say that me being sorry about this isn't the same as claiming legal responsibility, so you can't sue me, okay?
Okay. That's an important qualification. Thank you, Katie. But aside from all that mess, I'm actually looking forward to our annual Europeans Christmas party.
Yay!
We're recording our annual festive live episode this weekend on Sunday night for our Patreon supporters. And this year, also for people who are supporting our fundraiser that's running at the moment. I really cannot wait to see as many of you there as possible.
Have you got a nice ugly Christmas jumper you're going to be wearing?
Yeah, I'm actually almost wearing a Christmas jumper now. And I need to go hunting for some nice Christmassy snacks as well. So I can't wait.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We hope to see lots of you there.
Yes, we do. But back to this week. What have we got coming up in the show this week, Katie?
Coming up, a big question for you. What is the future of feminism, given the huge gulf in the way that young women and young men are starting to think and talk about gender inequality? Producer Kat and I sat down for a great conversation with three young people from Ireland, Greece, and Lithuania. They are three of the people heading to the Gender Equality Forum in Brussels next week. And they actually gave me a little bit of hope that maybe all is not lost.
Oh.
That is coming up after.
It's time for the part in the show where we discuss who's had a good week and who's had a bad week in Europe over the past week. And this week, we're doing it a bit differently than usual because we've both not been able to take our eyes off what has been happening in Romania over the past few weeks. I mentioned it on the show very briefly last week that the first round of the presidential election was won by a totally fringe, far-right, pro-Russian character, a guy who is actually too far right for the far right parties in Romania. He's a guy called Calin Georgescu, and he received 23% of the vote in the first round. A result that seemed so crazy that the Constitutional Court actually demanded a recount, partly because opinion polls had suggested up until a few days before that he was going to win only single digits of the vote. Like, some polls suggested he was only going to win 1% of the vote.
In the end, about 8 million votes were recounted, and the court ruled on Monday that even if the result of that first round was shocking, it should be accepted. So the second round of the presidential election is set to go ahead on Sunday, with Georgescu currently leading in the few polls that have been released. There have been calls, though, for TikTok to be suspended in Romania. Some people are accusing the Chinese-owned social media company of boosting Georgescu's content in a way that doesn't respect Romania's electoral rules. He's actually gained the nickname the TikTok Messiah, seeing as he came out of nowhere with this campaign that was almost exclusively run on TikTok.
And Katie, we haven't even talked about the fact that there were also parliamentary elections in Romania this past weekend, which was won by the incumbent Social Democratic Party, but far-right parties did grow in support, although they didn't take over the Social Democrats. So yeah, there was a bit of a sigh of relief in some of Romania, and especially in Brussels, that the government of an EU member state may not be moving as far right as could have happened. But how relieved can we be at this stage? It's not really clear yet.
So this week, given that Romania is going through one of the biggest political shocks of its modern history, we're going to do good week, bad week differently this week. We are limiting the conversation to this one country. And we're very excited to be joined by a very special guest to help us work out who has had a good week and who's had a bad week. A big warm welcome back to the show to our former producer, multi-award-winning investigative journalist, Andrei Popoviciu. Hi, Andrei.
Hi, everyone. Good to be back on the show.
Hey.
Nice to have you here.
Good to have you back, and weird circumstances to have you back. It must have been a tumultuous few weeks for you.
Yeah. Definitely. We could say the least.
Now, you know how this segment works. We talk about who has had a good week and who has had a bad week. Remember, there is no value judgment to that good or bad. Good week is by no means an endorsement. So with that in mind, let's start. Who do you think has had a good week this week in Romania?
Yeah, it was quite tough to choose who had a bad week and who had a good week because everyone had a bit of both. I think more bad than good. Mm-hmm. But I think I want to give good week to the Romanian democracy because, as you said, there was a demand for the presidential vote from the first tour to be recounted. And we just found out last night that the ranking is staying the same and that the votes didn't change. So we can give good week to democracy because the vote has stayed the same and there wasn't any big irregularities going on. But I'm saying that with a bit of caution because there was a lot of discussion around the Constitutional Court, who ordered this recount of the vote, about how it is politicized and how it has acted in the interests of the presidential candidate for the Social Democrats, who didn't make the cut for the second tour. And there was a lot of suspicion in the country and in the political scene about how this recount was ordered for him to be able to make the cut, because it's the first time in 35 years that none of the traditional mainstream political parties, the candidates of these parties, are not in the second tour of the election.
Mm.
So you're saying it's a good week that they decided not to annul those first round results, but that it's already quite something that they were considering annulling the results, right? That's already maybe having some shockwaves across the country.
Yeah, completely. And I think this decision has only polarized people even more because, as we know, there's a huge feeling of kind of betrayal and frustration by Romanians who feel that kind of the traditional mainstream political class has disappointed them and has been working against them. And this could have been another kind of proof of the system again working against them and trying to change the vote and trying to challenge basically what they've decided, just because not the right people made it to the first round. But yeah, luckily that didn't happen. And we're going ahead in the second tour with the initial candidates, Călin Georgescu and Elena Lasconi.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about this kind of wave of anger at the establishment and where it's coming from. You wrote a piece last week in The Guardian about discovering that your father had actually voted for this far-right candidate, Georgescu. Were you surprised to find that out? Like, why do you think he made that choice, your dad?
I don't think I was surprised. I think I was surprised that he chose him, and I didn't know that he was on the radar of so many people, including my father. I wasn't surprised that he didn't vote for any of the traditional political candidates because of this frustration I was talking about and because of this kind of disappointment in how things have been going for the past 35 years for him and for the rest of Romanians, including myself. A lot of people see the Elena Lasconi, the one who's made it to the second tour, as that candidate who will reform and who will change things. But they have been in government since around 2016, 2017, or they've been existing as a party and they've entered parliament before. They've had some ministers in government, so they've already kind of become this symbol of the establishment, even though they've never had a president or a prime minister in power. So even these kind of reformist parties and candidates who should usually be the choice for people who want to tax the incumbents and the mainstream parties, even these are considered now to belong to the establishment.
And that might be why it seems like Georgescu is leading in the few polls that have come out for this second round presidential election. Can we assume that he's the front runner at this stage?
It's hard to say. We've seen polls make mistakes before the first round of the presidential elections. He was never given any chance of passing into even past 10%, right, as you said. But I think what's making me believe that he has a very high possibility to win the presidency is what's happening in Romania and the discussions people are having in Romania. And what I see around myself and my family, friends, and everyone sees, I think that's, it could be a bit more of a representative sample than a lot of the polls who have been mistaken in the past. I mean, there's a lot more people who maybe even didn't vote in the first tour and now have found out about him and are being convinced. There's also people who have changed their mind and don't want to vote for him after they found out what he believes in. But I think it's very likely that he has a solid chance of winning. Yeah.
What are the kind of things that people are pissed off about when you say that, you know, your dad is frustrated that things haven't improved for 35 years? What things is he so angry about?
So a lot of people talk about corruption in Romania, right? And people need to understand that, you know, corruption is everywhere. In Romania, corruption goes deep, deep into society. You know, there's like state institutions where it's impossible to get a job without speaking to politically affiliated directors of these institutions. Mm. All the public institutions are politicized. So this kind of shows that unless you're connected, unless you know people in the right places, you'll never be able to kind of live with dignity, get those jobs, and access a lot of the things that should be normal and they should be based on meritocracy. And then there's a lot of issues about foreign influence in Romania. And I'm not talking about kind of Russian influence, but about how the EU and its kind of laws, do those take precedent over Romanian laws? And that's like something that a lot of people feel that their way of living and a lot of other things, they don't want it to be dictated by someone else. And it should be something that we decide within the country. And I think Georgescu has a big rhetoric about foreign companies and about making Romanian production a priority and making Romania a priority. There's a lot of discussion about land ownership by foreign companies. There's a lot of discussion about us exporting a lot of our goods and importing a lot of goods that we pay less for, but it's not ours. And, you know, there's a lot of grievances about institutions and their reform, but also about who's profiting off our land, off our resources, and that type of stuff. And I think, like, we've had, you know, the case of the gold mining in Roșia Montană, when, you know, you had those huge protests around the exploitation of gold in our country, and there was a foreign company that wanted to do it. You know, these are things that are not new. And I think he convinced people with his rhetoric of putting Romania first and trying to solve all these problems. He hasn't really said how he's going to implement it. And I think people don't really understand that. But I think his rhetoric resonates with people because he's always talking about putting Romania and Romanians first. And that's an option that the mainstream political parties are not providing.
So you're giving a very qualified good week to Romanian democracy, although it sounds like it's not in a brilliant state, to be honest. And it also sounds like Georgescu might be a good candidate for good week, seeing as he's going to be going into this second round, whereas it could have all turned upside down for him if the Constitutional Court had ruled differently. Who do you think should get bad week this week in Romania?
Yeah, I thought about this. And again, there's no clear candidate, but I think I would give a bad week to the Romanian traditional mainstream parties, the Social Democrats and the Liberals. And I'm giving bad week despite the Social Democrats having won the first spot for the parliamentary elections. They got 22%, which it should be a positive thing. Our listeners should know that this is one of their lowest score in parliamentary elections because they've been a powerhouse in Romanian politics, constantly being in government and constantly earning at least 35% of the votes for the past 30 years, even more than that. The fact that they've fell so much in the parliamentary elections says a lot about them. And the second thing is that the Liberals fell into third place, on top of the fact that their presidential candidate didn't even win past 10% for the presidential vote. Now they fell in third place at only just over 14%. In and of itself is bad, but what's worse is that the far right has been added to this mix. And the kind of original far right party, AUR, which has entered politics in the last parliamentary elections, are now in second place at just over 18%. And it's not only them. You have another extremist party, SOS Romania, who got almost 8% of the votes. And then, again, a virtually unknown party that has kind of rode on the back of Georgescu's win in the first round of elections, who got over 6%, and they have said that they are his main supporters. So now we have an additional two far-right parties entering parliament. They don't have enough votes to make a majority. They make just over 30%. But that is unprecedented in Romania, and it's news in itself. There will be an opposition, but they have never had so much power, the hard right.
Mm. Does their success have anything to do with Ukraine? Because I read that these parties have been trying to whip up fear that the war could spread across the border if Romania keeps supporting Ukraine.
Completely, yeah. The far-right movement in Romania has built on a lot of kind of consequential events for the past years. You know, we started with COVID and then we went on with the war in Ukraine, you know, which far-right voters see these issues as main issues that kind of lay bare the corruption within the Romanian state and the traditional parties. A lot of people do believe that if we go with the pro-European, pro-NATO parties, a lot of these far-right voters, they think we will be thrown in a war.
So what are the next steps now? I know we're waiting for the presidential election result for the second round to come in on Sunday, but what is the coalition forming going to look like? How is a government formed in Romania?
So none of the parties has complete majority to be able to name a prime minister and take over the government. So we'll have to have coalitions between the parties. The far right, again, don't have enough votes to form a coalition. So it will most likely be a coalition between the Social Democrats, which is a center-left party, the Liberals, which is a center-right party. We don't see that often across Europe where you have the left and the right forming coalitions. And then you have the reformists, the Save Romania Union, which is Elena Lasconi's party, the second presidential candidate, and then the Hungarian party. So these four parties could form a coalition that reaches over 60% in votes and percentages, and they could easily be able to form a government. But again, it's a government formed out of four parties, each of them with very different kind of views and ideologies. But what unites them is the pro-European aspect and the pro-NATO aspect. So we're stripping away a lot of the policies and the public policies that have defined these parties for so long. And we're looking at kind of very basic directions. Are we going to continue our pro-European, pro-NATO kind of direction, or are we going to isolate and withdraw within ourselves?
Well, thank you so much, Andrei, for joining us today and trying to fit things into this awful categorization of good week and bad week that we've made you use, because it definitely sounds like it's just been a dramatic few weeks. Let's say that.
Let's call it messy week.
Yeah.
It's probably more appropriate.
I agree. No winners here.
Thanks so much for coming in, Andrei.
Thank you.
Christmas is approaching, and if you want to find a way to mark the festive season with a good deed, you could do much worse than support our crowdfunder for a series we really want to make next year called Who Does It Best? It's a series in which we are hoping to find some of the best policies in Europe in the areas of housing, childcare, and drugs. We are so excited to make this series and are actually starting to believe we might be able to make it, because at the time of recording, we are almost three quarters of the way to our funding goal on this website for fund.
Yay!
But honestly, we've seen a pretty sharp slowdown in donations over the past week. So getting that final 25 or so percent could be a bit tricky. Can you help us out? Have you been thinking about it but not taken the plunge yet? Well, maybe this week is the week.
Especially if we're going to dangle the possibility of attending our Zoom Christmas party as a little bonus if you sign up.
True. If you sign up before Saturday lunchtime, then we'll make sure we can get the link to you so that you can join us on Sunday evening for the live recording, a rare glimpse of us talking where you can see our faces, which makes us feel a bit uncomfortable, but we're willing to do it for you all. There's a link in the show notes to this fundraiser, although I realized the other day that I think some people, maybe many people, have never seen the show notes of a podcast and don't know where they are. So if you don't know where they are, head to our website, which is europeanspodcast.com, and you'll see a banner snaking its way across the top of the homepage with a link to the fundraiser. We'd really like to have this fundraiser wrapped up by the end of the year so that we can get started on it in earnest as soon as 2025 begins.
We also remain extremely, extremely grateful to the wonderful people who fund the weekly operation of the Europeans, podcasts like the one that you're listening to right now, and the latest generous people to sign up to support that general running of the show via patreon.com are Vanessa, Mike, Robert, Guillermo, and Consuelo.
Thank you so much to all those Patreon supporters. I promise I'll stop talking about money soon, but I also wanted to mention that there's a new thing on Patreon where you can gift a Patreon membership to a friend or family member.
Oh. that's cool.
We've done this in the past casually. We've like arranged it, but now there's actually an official system on their website where a gift can be made properly. I'll put a link to that in the show notes too. A Patreon membership is the perfect gift for your friend who has everything they need already. And if you donate from the €11 a month tier or up, then you'll get a personalized mini episode for your friend, which is essentially a fancy voicemail with jingles. So keep that in mind when you're doing your Christmas shopping.
I am joined for this week's interview by producer Katz. Hi, Katz.
Hello, Katz.
Hi.
Tell us what brings you to these sunny shores.
How dare you? You invited me. Well, next Tuesday and Wednesday, hundreds of people are going to be headed to Brussels for the Gender Equality Forum. Activists, experts, people who make policies, and they are going to be talking about how to make things more equal on our continent, which still has, among other things, a big gender pay gap and a massive problem with violence against women, to name a few. And this year, the event is specifically aimed at young Europeans.
Yeah, and I think it's actually really interesting that the organizers have decided to focus this year on how young people feel about feminism and gender equality right now. Because it does feel like we're living through a time when attitudes are really shifting on that front. Like, you're seeing more and more young men across Europe becoming admirers of misogynistic influencers like Andrew Tate. You're also seeing young people start to vote differently. I mean, everyone listening to this will probably have seen headlines about this rather stark gender gap in terms of how young people voted in the US election, with a majority of young men backing Trump and a majority of young women backing Harris. That is not just a phenomenon happening on the other side of the Atlantic. Like in Germany, for example, men aged 18 to 29 are roughly twice as likely to vote for the AfD as women the same age. And we're seeing similar divides between young men and young women really all across Europe, from the UK to Spain.
Yeah, and I think it's quite wild that, like, I'm only a few years older than that generation, and they're growing up in a really different time than we are. Like, when I was younger, it felt like things were only going to get more progressive. Like, we weren't there yet, but that was just the destination, clearly.
Right.
And that's really not the world that younger people than us, you know, even just 5 years younger, are growing up in. So we thought it would be really interesting to talk to people who are actually part of this generation about what they make of this trend. We invited three people who are going to be at the Gender Equality Forum. They are Silue Musoke, a politics student from Ireland living in the Netherlands, Goda Skiotite, she is a public policy researcher in Lithuania, and Chris Donis is an Albanian Greek student living in Sweden.
We had a great conversation with all three of them in collaboration with the European Institute for Gender Equality. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Silue, Goda, Chris, so nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Likewise.
Starting with you, Chris, is there something happened in your own life that made you realize how gendered the world was around you and that this was a subject you cared about?
Ever since I was like at the beginning of my childhood, I was living with my grandparents and my parents, so a lot of people in the same house. And I was observing the differences within the family when it came to like gender norms. For example, I saw like my grandpa was in the military, so he had a very traditionally male job. And I was observing that that was seen as something traditionally male. So my grandma would never perceive that she could ever have any role in the military. Further down a generation, and I saw my dad still holding similar values, I was seeing my mom have a very contrasting opinion when it came to like labor. So she thought that if she wanted to, she could be in the military. If she wanted to, she could work very traditionally male-dominated jobs. And then all of those different observations were also contrasting my own from like my friends' families in Greece, because all of my family's from Albania. I was born and raised in Greece. So I had this very contrasting observation. And at that point I was like, okay, like gender is perceived very differently, even in the context of the family, which is really, really important for people. So that kind of got me thinking, like, as a man and as a person that does want to fight for equal rights, what can be done?
Gorda, what about you? Because I know that your sort of feminist awakening is also something that happened in your family, really.
Yeah, I was actually relating a lot to Chris. Understanding about gender and gender roles that come from the family. And for me, it was a very different experience in the sense of that I was mainly raised by a single mom. The differences that I saw in terms of, yeah, how gender influences, let's say, parenting decisions came from her raising me and my brother differently, even though she was a woman raising two children alone. And I do have a dad, so not to like say that he didn't play a role. Obviously he did, but it's just a smaller one. To go back to my point, I was surrounded a lot by strong women in my life. Yeah, and I think that's what kind of created a sort of kind of confusion in my head, because they were all behaving like not as very traditional women. But then my mom would still try to kind of ingrain more traditional values in me and my brother, bringing back to the sort of small examples in everyday life, division of chores, and saying to my brother that, oh, you're supposed to take out the trash because you're a man. And I was like, what? And I never understood that. So that's something that I think got me thinking. It's not that something that was like immediately clear to me, but I think, let's call this my feminist awakening and kind of trying to understand my mom's decisions and the dynamics around me. So, yeah.
And if I may say at this point, like you made a very interesting observation, because looking back, I have only had female friends for the most part. When I moved abroad at 18, I had no idea how to do anything. I didn't know how to clean the house. I didn't know how to cook for myself. I didn't know how I would be able to survive without my parents' help. But then I was telling that to my female friends and they were all like, why don't you know? Mm-hmm. Because for them, like these things they had been doing for their entirety of their childhood. So that is very, very interesting observation, honestly.
I think we don't realize how much gender roles or norms or stereotypes play into the interests you have or the things you do and don't know how to do. Yeah, we think it's this big, abstract, faraway thing when it's impacted us one way or another in our everyday lives.
Hmm. Was there a moment for you, Siloe, that made you think, huh, gender is something that is present in my life or in the world around me?
Yeah, I will say yes. So I'm born and raised in Dublin, Ireland, but my parents are originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo in Central Africa. And so I've grown up in Ireland. It's quite progressive. I've seen men and women be treated relatively equally. Whereas when I think of back home in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there's a war ongoing in the East. And over there, gender-based violence or rape as a weapon of war is a big thing. And the treatment of women over there is pretty much appalling. And so in growing up in a household where that has been a topic of discussion or conversation or something that kind of personally affects us, it's kind of opened up my eyes or had my feminist awakening where I've kind of realized that, okay, the treatment of women is so different everywhere in the world, or even within the Irish context itself, I've seen disparities. So kind of growing up in that, you know, multicultural household, I've been able to identify both. And yeah, it's kind of been moments super, super young where I've realized the stark difference in the treatments of men and women.
You've all described like how you noticed that gender was a thing, but I'm wondering what made you decide this is something I actually want to work on?
I think it started for me in my bachelor's degree. So I did my bachelor's in economics, and something I noticed from the first day until the final day was there was a lot less women in my bachelor's degree than men. In final year, out of a class of 30, I think there were 7 of us that were women that graduated compared to the 23 other men. Mm. And in Ireland, I think only 25% of women are represented in STEM subjects compared to 75% of men. So it's kind of, it comes back again to the thing of how stereotypes and cultural norms can really influence our decisions and representation, and that kind of has a domino effect in society overall. And so it's something that really struck me. That's something that made me really want to promote women's participation in education and politics.
Kat and I are a little bit older than you three.
Just a few years.
Let's not dwell on it. And one of the things that we have been talking about a little bit recently is that in several elections around the world, we're starting to see this divergence in the way that young men and young women vote. And also, you know, when you hear from young people like yourselves about how people talk about gender in their daily lives, you're hearing divergences there in the way that young women and young men talk about gender. And I'm really curious, is this something that you've seen in your own lives?
I do see this divergence quite clearly, again, in the example of me and my brother. We're quite close apart. We're only a year and 3 months. Yeah, difference. I'm a bit older than him. But, and he's not, let's say he's not engaged politically. I was the one who, let's say, studied all of these like social political issues. And he's a creative, he's a photographer. He's in that kind of space, which usually I think is progressive, but I see his views going like not backwards, but towards sometimes more conservative perspectives. And we've had this summer, this very big discussion on whether the gender pay gap exists, and that in his mind, it doesn't exist. And I was like, whoa, okay. And wow. I definitely see more and more that our views diverge. And he has even called me a couple of years ago, like a crazy feminist. I was like, okay. Yeah, it's definitely creates tension and some friction in like our, let's say, personal relationships. But the only reason that I can find and the only explanation I can find to his views, because that's definitely not coming from, let's say, our family. The main force, I think, is social media. And sometimes I see like his feed and like we share some videos and some of these things are wild that are out there. And that's, I think, a force that has been gaining more and more ground. And that could explain the divergences that are being created between young men and young women, and then subsequently what they believe and then how they vote.
I can see the other two of you nodding there. Siloes, is something you recognize?
Yeah, when you mentioned social media, I think lately, maybe with the rise of like super misogynistic influencers, like Andrew Tate is a big example, they kind of radicalize men where women's rights or the advancements of women, they make it sound as if it's a threat to masculinity or a threat to men, when in actuality, it is something that should be seen as positive. You have kind of like this reactive anti-feminist misogyny that they're kind of putting out there and feeding to men, and it's making it seem as if the advancements of women or the equality or equity of women is a negative thing, which is quite scary to see, especially how much ground they take up because their voices are so heard. I mean, everybody knows who Andrew Tate is, everybody knows what he's about, and sadly, you know, certain men are being radicalized or believe these views, which are really damaging when you think about it.
I think that these like social media personalities like Andrew Tate, and I would go as far as to say that politicians as well around the world who are also using social media as platforms, right? And it's really, really easy for young people and young men in specific, which I'm also personally observing this rise in, get in these echo chambers and really believe that the entire world believes these things and that these are like beliefs that are, I don't know, like valid or whatnot. Yeah. And especially when you consider who is actually voicing these opinions, people who have had like records of sexual abuse and just really, really just not credible at all information that they're putting out there. But I would say, apart from just this general spread of this information, you would call it, I think that the prominence of these personalities has also created the grounds for other people to speak up about this. So it has created a culture that has normalized these anti-feminist and these misogynistic values and opinions are now like more than ever more widely accepted. Social media platforms themselves not putting in the work to actually ensure the validity and just overall protection of
people.
people.
Yes, just people in general, honestly.
No.
And it's super, super sad to observe.
Yeah.
I have a question that's kind of related. I mean, I am the mother of a small boy. He's a baby. It's going to be quite some time before he's going on social media, and social media is almost definitely going to look very different. But I'm already like getting anxious in advance about like the kind of role models that he's going to be finding. Mm-hmm. And I feel like part of this bigger question of around feminism that we have at the moment is this idea of masculinity and what a good positive form of masculinity looks like. Mm. How can we promote a form of masculinity that is not the Andrew Tate form of masculinity? And what would that look like to you?
I mean, I've looked at these really toxic forms of masculinity. I've looked at very positive forms of masculinity and what that actually looks like. And I would say the main difference I would observe is emotional intelligence and just overall having like critical thinking. Like, these are the two main things. If you're able to have proper emotional intelligence, be able to develop empathy, understand people, communicate properly, and see what people say, compare that with the people in your environment. As a man, what do women feel like? What do other people feel like? As a woman, what do men feel like? So having that compassion, that empathy, and being able to communicate that properly, I would say is of utmost importance when it comes to this issue. And of course, being able to filter everything you see, especially online, thinking critically about whether this is information that can be good to you or information that you just don't really know what to do with, that most of these toxically masculine influencers are promoting, right? These very, very basic things that start from family, from education, fundamental social surroundings can actually help with.
These are terribly important things and skills, but they're so hard to teach. I think I just want to like acknowledge that out there. Like, they do sound like solutions, but they're not practical and they're not easy to implement. And
yeah,
I like to be a practical person. And like, I like to talk about these sort of big ideas, and these are very important ideas. But then when I think about how to actually implement that into sort of day-to-day life, these very hard questions, but they have to be raised, and it's going to look differently in different country, in a different city, in a different school, in a different family.
Yeah.
So as long as we're talking about that and raising sort of awareness about that, that's great. And yeah, hopefully that reaches sort of, they can actually get implemented sort of practically.
Mm-hmm. But that's a good point that you made actually about how it looks different in different environments, just because I think when we talk about gender equality, sometimes we split it into just men and women, when there's so many different other factors that come into play: your socioeconomic background, your race, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation. There's so many different factors that play into this. And so, like you said, it does look different in different environments and scopes. And I think you can't look at it by just two separate things. There's so much more interplayers, so much more things that are involved in that. So very good point, actually, yeah.
Just to play devil's advocate a little, I've also looked into these like toxic masculinity videos, and I think they also frame what they're doing as critical thinking, which makes it really difficult. Again, this is too big of a question for us to solve as the five presidents of the world today, but is there anything you think we can do about the polarization that already exists in the generation that you're a part of?
This is a very big question indeed. but yeah, very boring answer is to start from your own circle and start from your own, I don't know, friends, family, and try to tackle that polarization there. It's really hard. I don't think there's any other way.
Having conversations with my sibling as well, he is like 6 years younger than me. I think he's like considered Gen Alpha, if I'm not mistaken. I'm also noticing like an even larger like polarization there. And that has also concerned me a lot. Like, I have tried to do my part, convince him, talk to him through like, this is why the people that you see on social media and your friends are not giving you like the opinions that you should be actually considering.
What kind of things is he saying?
I mean, it kind of spans a lot of different things. He has said a lot about, like, homosexuality, for example, and him having a gay brother is not really helping that. He's also said a lot of things about gender norms, for example, you know. And I would say I have tried to help a lot in a lot of cases successfully, because I think when you have people in your social circles that can help you understand at its root why certain opinions that you hear from strangers are not really valuable to you and you're like thinking of the world, it helps a lot. I know it certainly helped my brother. So now he's a bit better at that, step by step. But I think like what this got me thinking was starting off from like just like us, the way that we communicate with other people, but also like the true influencers of society, the teachers, the journalists, the people that can truly help shift your own perspectives of things.
I think sometimes we think that when it comes to maybe gender equality or whatever, we think it's this big thing that only politicians and, you know, lawyers and the larger people in society, and I say that in quotation marks, can speak about or can influence, when in reality, it really can just begin by conversations. I think for myself even, I've had certain conversations with my dad, for example, who might hold maybe slightly more conservative views than me. I've had conversations with him and he's been like, you know what? I see where you're coming from. And he's changed his mind. And I've had a little pat my back moment where I've been like, I've done my little step for feminism. And it really just does begin with those small conversations or those small things. And, you know, it can open up people's way of thinking, people's mindsets, people's views. And that kind of has a domino effect into, you know, what you believe, what you put out there. It might make you think twice about the content you consume. And yeah, I really think it does begin by conversations more than anything, even amongst peers or classmates or neighbors, families, friends.
Maybe the only thing that I could add on the last point on starting with a conversation, it's also important to stay safe and not, you know, sacrifice your own mental health and your own, psychological safety in all of those cases. So choose your battles.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, these are important conversations. And I'm glad I've had quite a few of them in my circle, but some of them can wait. And stay safe out there.
Katie, you know what I was thinking as this conversation was wrapping up?
What were you thinking?
Well, if the whole thing that we have to do is have conversations with each other, that means we're going to have to learn to have hard conversations with each other.
So exhausting. That feels kind of like the thread that's tying this whole episode together. When you think about Romania and this like political divide that's happening all across this continent, all across the world, really, having hard conversations with people that think differently from us is the general theme. And I'm kind of scared of that.
I understand. I'm scared of it too. Although I will say that I've read a couple of books in the past few years about how to have hard conversations or how to like explicitly not agree with each other in a way that still feels constructive. One of them is actually a book by Anna Sale, the political journalist who's now host of Death, Sex and Money.
Great podcast.
And she actually wrote a book called Let's Talk About Hard Things.
That's going straight on my Christmas list.
Yeah. So let's practice for a minute. We already talked about how our generation grew up in a really different moment. And I was thinking, do you remember like signs from, say, when you were doing your bachelor's that maybe this gender divide was going to get bigger again?
A little bit. I mean, I was surrounded by pretty progressive men, but I do remember feeling the sense of unease when confronted by, let's say, a quite strident feminist friend of just like, men are to blame for everything. Men around me not knowing what to do with that. And now when I look at the way that young men are talking about how they're being held responsible for everything and it's not fair, I can see this grain of like a sort of reaction to that of like, well, we're not to blame for everything. And why are you assuming that I'm guilty before I've even done anything? I can kind of see where that came from. And it doesn't make me feel very comfortable.
Yeah, and I suspect that those are the moments where maybe we should get better at like opening the conversation. I also remember in my bachelor's, I studied science and I was surrounded by progressive men. But I do remember that like there was a bit of an energy of like, yeah, but you guys in Amsterdam, you don't experience sexism. Like that's like an old thing or a thing that's of elsewhere. And it felt a bit like we were living in different universes of like, no, no, it really still is here. But I didn't really feel like they believed us. And then those were conversations that we didn't dare to have. We didn't say like, hey, let's talk about this. Maybe we should have. I don't know.
Well, after we've read your book recommendation, I think that we'll all be better prepared to actually have those convos, although maybe not over the Christmas dinner table itself.
Maybe we can save it for Blue Monday in January.
Can't wait. Thank you so much to Siloé, Goda and Chris for joining us. You will be pleased to hear that you do not need to be in Brussels to attend the Gender Equality Forum on December 10th and 11th. You can follow all of the speakers virtually at home through the magic of technology. And we've just heard that those speakers are actually going to include the new European Commissioner for Equality, Hajda Labib. So it'll be really interesting to hear from her, fresh after taking office a week ago. You will find a link for how to sign up to the forum in the show notes. Dominic Kramer, what have you been enjoying this week?
Well, as you may have heard last week, I took a trip down to Barcelona by train from Amsterdam and I stopped off in Paris on both the way and the way back.
You did.
To break up the journey. I'd hoped to see Katie on the way back from my Barcelona trip, but Katie's household had all come down with the norovirus. Are you all okay?
It was a wash with diarrhea. Are you sad that you avoided my household on the way back?
I am quite pleased that I didn't come by your household.
This is maybe too much information. Moving on.
Anyway, it meant that I spent the evening aimlessly wandering around Paris with my husband, which was really nice. And we found ourselves in the Pompidou Center at around 8:30 in the evening. And it was still open and pretty empty, which felt like a miracle to me because I'd actually never been inside it.
You know.
And I know everyone knows about the Pompidou Center, but it's so iconic. The inside-out design, it feels really magical. And it felt like we were hacking the system by just wandering around the bits of the building that we could without even having to pay anything.
Nice.
So yeah, my first cultural tip is that I really recommend a spontaneous evening trip into the Pompidou Center if you're in Paris and wondering what to do after dinner. And a really weird thing happened. As I was going up those iconic escalators, I started hearing nature noises and then I noticed someone talking and I thought, I know that voice.
I know what you're talking about.
You do?
Yeah, Kat sent this to me.
Whose voice was it?
It was Björk's voice.
Yes, the Icelandic superstar Björk. And it was only then that I remembered that Kat, our producer, she'd apparently also sent it to you, but she'd sent me a link about this cool sound art piece that Björk has made that's running in the Pompidou Center at the moment. And without even realizing, I had accidentally stumbled into it. And it really blew me and my husband away. It's a piece called Nature Manifesto, and it's heard along the length of all the escalators of the Pompidou Center, escalators that are colloquially known as the caterpillar. And it's a post-optimistic manifesto on nature that she made with the Lebanese composer Aleph. And I have to say, I was really moved by it. So if you're in Paris this weekend, then do drop by. It's free to experience and it actually closes at the beginning of next week. If you're not in Paris this weekend, then I think it's still interesting to read the text of the manifesto, which I'll link to in the show notes. Those show notes are getting full today.
They really are.
It really helped me as a reflection on the weird time in history and in the climate crisis that we're living through right now. I was going to read some of it out, but actually I think you should just listen to Björk saying it instead. But thank you, Kat, for recommending it, and apologies for only ending up there accidentally, but I'm glad I did. There must have been something magnetic that Björk put into the building to pull me towards the Pompidou Center.
I'm going to check it out this weekend now that my household is less awash with diarrhea.
What have you been enjoying, Katie, from the toilet seat?
It's inappropriate now because I've got a recipe for you.
Oh, no.
It is officially soup season, and I've got a few different soups on rotation. But I thought I'd freshen it up last week before we got sick. And I tried out a recipe for a Finnish salmon soup called lohikeitto, which a lot of you from the Nordic part of the world will know of. There are versions of the soup in other Nordic countries too. But it does seem to be primarily associated with Finland, this soup. It's pretty simple. It's got salmon in it, potatoes, carrots, root vegetables, a bit of cream, fish stock and dill. And that's kind of it. Like, I really wasn't expecting very much from this soup, but it is delicious. I would go so far as to say it is my favorite soup at the moment. I want to make it again already. So if you do eat fish and you are looking for a winter warmer that is rich in omega-3 and pretty quick and easy to make, make yourself some lohikeitto. I'm going to put a recipe in the show notes. Those very, very full show notes.
Is this another recipe you got on TikTok?
Actually from YouTube this time.
Okay. Yeah, when I was staying with Katie, I discovered that she does so much of her cooking from TikTok.
I know.
You're so Gen Z. Or is that just a very millennial way of using TikTok, maybe?
Well, apparently lots of older Romanian voters are also glued to the thing. So it's not just me.
I have a fun, happy ending to round off this show. Now, I'm sure most of you have probably heard about the cult classic film Snakes on a Plane.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we need to make a European remake of the film called Hamsters on a Plane after reports emerged in the Portuguese press of 132 hamsters escaping their cages during a flight from Lisbon to Ponta Delgada on the São Miguel Island.
Why were there so many hamsters on this plane?
Yeah, that was also my first question. Apparently it was part of a shipment of pets to a pet shop on the island of São Miguel, which is in the Atlantic, part of the Portuguese Azores. So, yeah, luggage handlers noticed that something was amiss when they were emptying the transport boxes and saw that the hamster boxes were empty and damaged.
Oh, no!
So 132 hamsters had made a great escape into the plane, and the plane ended up having to be grounded for 4 days.
What?
Whilst they tried to catch all of the hamsters that were on the loose.
Did they get them all back?
I think so. Actually, the reporting didn't say that all 132 were caught, but there are some amazing videos of like luggage handlers seeing like little hamsters running around this huge aeroplane. So, yeah, it cheered me up. I mean, it's maybe a bit bleak as well to imagine these poor hamsters desperately running around a plane trying to get away, but it's disturbing and also cheering at the same time.
We will be back next week for the last episode of the year, a festive extravaganza recorded live on Zoom in front of supporters of this podcast. In the meantime, come and hang out with us at the new place, Blue Sky. I did my first thread there this week, Dominic. It felt quite nice.
Oh, did you?
I did.
I missed it. Sorry.
Go check it out. We're at, what are we?
At europeanspod.bsky.social.
And we're also on Instagram and Mastodon. And actually, speaking of Instagram, didn't you promise to post some pictures of yourself standing next to a regenerative braking hub in Barcelona?
Yeah, I feel a bit guilty about it. I didn't find it. I'm sorry.
Dominic, this is why trust in podcasters is declining.
It's true. Okay, well, to make up for it this week, I will promise to post a video of myself at the top of the Caterpillar escalators in the Pompidou Centre. And I have to say, it's quite embarrassing because my husband was like, why don't I film you like here for the podcast? Because we realised we'd failed at our Barcelona Instagramming. And I just can't do it. I can't be filmed and look natural. And I don't know how people do this influencing. So,
what do you mean? You're a professional performer. You're on stage all the time.
Yeah, it's a different thing doing something theatrical and like pretending to be yourself on holiday, just and you happen to be being filmed. So I'll humiliate myself and put up the really terrible video content I made at the top of this Pompidou Centre if you follow us on Instagram at Europeans Podcast.
How enticing. This week's episode was produced by Morgan Charles and Kat Slaslo. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
L'arrivedere.
Bye.